I sent him a note yesterday to say that if you had retired from the House of Commons, you have now taken lordship. Now we just called you our energy champion. Welcome to Minister and CEO. We're going to just deal with some housekeeping issues first, not all of them, but just quickly, straight after this meeting, which adjourns at 1 o'clock, the ANC will remain in this venue for a study group. Lunch will be served here, and so we'll have a working lunch, so to speak. I take it as all. I'm being looked at this big surprise look. I'm not sure why. I take it you've all gotten notices. So please just hang around. We won't be very long. Okay. For the rest, we'll deal with the. I take it everybody's got copies of the program for this term. The one aspect of that program that has not been finalized is the issue of the 12th of March. Which will either be a visit to ESCOM or to Transnet. We have to sort out the detail of that, and we will then discuss the program at a different time. What I did want to do is immediately just start, because we do want to give as much time as possible for members to interact with the presentation and ask as many questions and take as many comments as possible. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to Minister to make some introductory comments and then take us between the two of you into the presentation, and then we'll go straight into interactive mode, and we'll take discussions and questions and answer sessions right up to 1 o'clock. Over to you. Just to also welcome those members of the NCLP who are here. I don't think we've met, so I don't really know you. But the chairperson, welcome to you, ma'am. And what we will do is, from this side, be co-chairing. So Ms. Temba will be handling the interactive session. And should be chairing over those proceedings. So, with those few comments, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. What we'd like to do, we've handed out one presentation. I think you had that earlier prepared by DPE. It's a pretty detailed presentation. Covering the background, the current measures, and quite a lot of detail on the proposed power conservation plan. It also gives some examples, as you look at it, of how an incident and issues unfold during a day, which puts pressure on the system. But our feeling was that it's probably very long and detailed, so what I'll do is make just a few introductory remarks, and then a shortened version of that, if you like, would be presented by Jacob Morocha, the Chief Executive. We also felt it's useful to give you the ESCOM presentation, because this is essentially the kind of interaction and presentation we've been giving to organized business, to the mines and many others. So you'll get a picture of exactly what it is we've been interacting about with the economic actors. So briefly, by way of some introductory remarks, understandably, the two of us sitting here have been getting quite a lot of flack over the last few weeks. And clearly, what hit us in this period of the last 3 or 4 weeks, although you'll see some of the changes, was something that as government, as ESCOM, as everybody, we really would have wanted to avoid, and it's quite clearly a major problem that has emerged over that period. However, what we want to indicate is that we must also not make the mistake of overstating or exaggerating the nature of the problem, because that can create an impression which is not necessarily accurate and can get us into a position where there's a decline of confidence that really is not merited by the exact facts. So the doom and gloom is something that we feel should be assessed much more carefully and more accurately. We will certainly, as government and as Eskom, go back in our tracks over the last 5 or 6 years fairly soon and get some outside observers to track the processes, the decision-making processes, the timing, because it's clearly a lesson we need to learn. There are issues that we will find within government, there's issues within Eskom, and there's some very interesting and important changes in the structure of our economy. So we would certainly want to get an accurate rather than an emotive hindsight view of the event. Because we need to plan for it. It might be that it also has implications for other large network systems in the economy. This interplay between the policies that we make, the changes in our economy, and the actual supply of key services. The underlying position we've known for some time, and that was, as the President and others have said, as we look back, the key delay was not so much in putting new capacity in, because as you've seen, there was new capacity being put in. But as we look back, the key delay was that in building a big new baseload station. And if we had had a large baseload station in place, where it was likely to come in earlier, 2009, 2010, we would certainly be feeling a lot more comfortable. And as you'll see, it's this pressure on the system that causes many of the problems. In hindsight, well, looking at it too, I think those of you who've taken the time to read the 1998 white paper fully is an instructive lesson. Because you're talking about a period in 1998-99 where the white paper summarizes the global energy position and says that the threat of energy security has receded. It says that most countries feel that they've got energy security, they're doing this through cross-border trade, through opening their markets, through bringing in private investors. And that was an accurate summation of the position that was seen in the world then. By 2004, this has changed quite dramatically. Where the question of energy security was no longer taken for granted at all. And a number of factors contributed to that. Some of the experience in the United States, Chile, Brazil, where suddenly very similar emergencies and crises that we've experienced hit them for different reasons. But also you had a situation like Europe, where Russia started to flex its muscle and slow down gas supplies into Europe. And the Europeans suddenly realized, oh, wait a bit, this cross-border trade in energy is not quite as easy as we thought it was. You had the massive growth in demand for electrical generating equipment arising from the growth of the Indian, Chinese, Russian, and Brazilian economies. You had the report of the Committee of Experts on Climate Change, which pointed to a more serious position than we had originally thought. About rising global temperatures, so that from being, if you read the 1998 paper, it records that most countries had stopped building nuclear power stations apart from China, which was true then. Of course, today it's not true at all. Virtually the whole world, bar one major country, is building nuclear stations. So we very clearly in a different environment, and that environment became pretty evident in 2004. And that's where the major decisions were taken to get Eskom to be responsible for the key big baseload stations. And that program is moving, as we will show you, quite quickly. But the building of a massive baseload station of roughly 4,000 megawatts is not something you do overnight. It's a big project. It's going to take quite a bit of time. But you'll see too that there's been considerable pre-planning about what the capacity is. So it's not as if we have to now sit down and think, well, what project should we take off the shelf? We know what we can do. It's a question of which one you move faster, how, when, and where. So the situation we're in, we've styled as government and emergency, and we've used the word carefully. I mean, it's a situation where if we respond with emergency responses, we should pull ourselves out of the position quickly. And tentatively, as Jacob will show you, we encourage, but we're tentative because we're still in a difficult position. But it's clear from past experience and even our own early day experience that a quick emergency type response can help you stabilize things quite quickly. The position, and I want to stress this, the position that we'll set out is not some halt to economic growth. What we have to do, however, is just manage more carefully planned new linkages. And I really need to stress this. If we're talking about an existing contract, let us take a big and complex one like Alcan. We've got contractual obligations. If they don't do something, they pay. If we don't do something, we pay. The question that we have to discuss with something as big as Alcan is, all right, tell us precisely when you will start your project. Now, we've got contractual dates that they must do. But when will it start? At what pace will we ramp up the demand? Can we match that with strengthening the grid in the Eastern Cape? Should we bring in an IPP in Kuka, which has been considered for a long time now? So what happens is not some dramatic decision, everything must stop. It's a question of saying, okay, now let's sit down more carefully and let's see what it is we can do and what we can't do. And it's the same with all big projects. Those projects, so we've got to talk more carefully. Now, if someone comes along and says, look, we want to put up a project that needs 100 megawatts and we need it in 2012, well, it's a completely different situation. And those of you who are familiar with it, I'm sure 100 megawatts is a big project. It's going to be a big mine or a big factory or a big smelter or something like that. And if they're only approaching us now, we can be certain that they must be 2 or 3 years away from doing it, because you don't build big mines, big factories in 2 days. So I really want us to get a more even-handed approach to what's happening and how we can talk these things through and deal with them. And finally, let me say that, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, in some detail, there's considerable opportunities in this. The build program itself, as you'll see, is massive. It's really very big. But the developments now that are happening in other forms of energy provision are also very important and interesting in the areas of solar, and other types of equipment that are emerging. So we need to work our way through this emergency, get to a more stable period, and we accept that the gap between available supply and rising demand will remain a relatively tight one for the next 4 years. Some of the steps that we propose to take in this next 2 years could ease that up in the second 2 years, but we don't have sufficient contracted certainty about that as yet. But it is it has been a very difficult situation, a very problematic one. And if I may, I'd like to ask Jacob just to take you through once again. Some of this you may be familiar. Some of the journalists said, "What's new to be said?" Well, you'll see there are one or two new points about how much we are saving and where we could do more. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chairperson, for the opportunity to address the committee, and thanks to the members of the committee. I will use this side of the presentation because I can see, so if members could focus on that one, because I'll be able also to point. I would start members, I'll start with the challenges that at ESCOM we've identified middle of last year. It was a conversation that we had when I was appointed as chief executive to say, what are the key issues, key challenges for ESCOM in this period. To summarize each point, the first one is ensuring continued supply, and that comes in the context of a very, very tight system. When you look at the events of the Western Cape 2005-2006, I think they highlighted certain specific issues that we need to deal with from a continuous supply. And when you project into the future, the effort of keeping the lines burning was going to be a very big one. And I think this January has really demonstrated the kind of challenges that we have. The second point and the second challenge is successfully executing the capacity expansion program by all standard. What we are embarking on is one of the biggest expansion programs in the world. And as I will show you, we actually are doubling up the size of Eskom by 2025, from 40,000 to 80,000, and in the context of a world where similar activities are happening, and more notably in China and India. So the kind of global challenges that are associated with capacity expansion and power are global. And we are also part of that. The third one is maintaining financial sustainability of Eskom. We've come from 20 years of excess capacity that we were able to respond to the increasing demand of electricity without building any power station. Now we have to double up the size of Eskom to be able to respond to the demand. That comes at a price, and it begin to put a strain on the financial health of Eskom, and we'll talk about what are the issues there. Responding to climate change, we are largely a coal-based generation capacity. As you know, the issues of global warming and climate change are becoming very significant global issues, and we have to reflect on what do we really need to do to reduce our CO2 emissions and what options we have to move away from only coal. And we'll talk about what are the things that we're doing there. The fifth challenge, decisions and policy have been determined around the consolidation of the industry, of the distribution industry, moving from the current 108 municipalities in Eskom to 6 entities. That's a major consolidation effort. And in doing that, we need to reflect on the management capacity of Eskom and the ability to successfully execute this in the next few years. The last one is an obvious one, I think, in the current context, that electricity is an important aspect of life and economy in South Africa, and we need to demonstrate and we need to up the confidence in the system in the current constrained tight supply. So those are the six challenges that Eskom articulated as important for us to be successful in this period. What led to this situation? What led to this current tight situation? I think the minister has already articulated some of the issues. The first one, I think we acknowledge that we have started late in terms of the new build program, particularly of base load station. Consequently, we have insufficient reserve margin. Now, the reserve margin is required that if we have any short-term problems, you've got room to handle. Either you've got problem on the supply or a immediate increase on the demand. Reserve margin helps you with that. If you don't have sufficient reserve margin, you start impacting on customers if you've got a short-term problem. The other issue right across the industry, which we contributed to this, is medium-term planning effectiveness, policy environments, are planning, regulatory environments on ourselves, the coordination of that so that we can move in unison and do the right things. We need to reflect and say it has not been as effective as it should be. The last point is that the economy has grown much faster than we anticipated. I think if you said in 1994 that by today would have had a power system that has grown by 50%, I think there would be skeptics that would have said, look, you know, your basis is not correct. But that has happened and has contributed to the current situation. And just in graphical terms, when you talk reserve margin, we're showing here the demand from 1988 to projection for 2008 peak demand. you could see, let me just explain the slide. The red line shows the operational capacity, the black line shows the installed capacity. The difference between operational and installed is the fact that we've got plant that is still in mothballs that we're demothballing, so that's the gap. But what is important is that the gap between demand, which is the blue bars, and the red line, that gap represents excess capacity. As you could see, we had lots of white spaces over the past almost 20 years, and when you go to the late 2006, 2007, you could see the space is constrained. That space, the constraining space, represents the diminishing of reserve margin. We're now running below 10, and our aspiration is 15. To be able to run the system comfortably, require reserve margin of 15. And when you look at 1994 and 2007, you could see that's the 50% growth in demand that we're talking about, and that's also contributed to where we are today.
Just to show you, the thing that really we have to grapple with was this period here. Okay, don't worry. But if you looked at that diagram and you'll see it, you see that the demand looks relatively historically, there it is. The models that we worked on showed an historical situation of a growth rate. For any years of growth, you had a certain ratio of electricity demand. You can see it's relatively stable, despite the fact that demand's growing. These things are relatively stable. See a big jump. This is where we have the really big jumps. And to adjust in a period of a year and a half, basically we just have been unable to do it.
The other element that we needed to grapple with is the issue of the usage of our generation plant. If we have excess capacity, the usage of each unit is low because we've got excess capacity. Now, as the demand grows, our usage of each unit of our generation plant has been high. And we measure it in what is called a generation load factor.
Just as a point of order or information, the presentation we got, it's difficult to follow our presentation with the one. Will we get a copy of it? Okay.
Thank you. Now, this is a plot of what we call generation load factor. That is the percentage usage of our generation plant. You could see prior to 2002, the usage has been fairly low, and it actually went down. And from January 2002 and going up to 2007, you see we actually running our plant harder. The usage has moved from an average of below 6%, we're now running at an average of about 74%. So the plant that we have, we're running harder. The consequences of that is we're having more wear and tear on the plant, there's more frequency in terms of the current problems, and we have now been able to quantify that there's a linear relation between the usage of the plant and the unplanned maintenance, and I'll show you the kind of challenges that represent in the next few slides. In terms of supply interruptions, just to give you the most high-profile supply interruptions, we had the Cape incident related to Quebec in 2004-2006, limited to the Cape. Then in January 2007, we had a national load-shedding event. That was the first load-shedding event that we had in recent history in South Africa. We had a relatively very successful winter for 2007, and only in October we started having an increasing number of load shedding events. From October, almost every month, average 2 to 3 events. Then in January, since the 9th of January up to the 4th of February, we almost have been load shedding on a daily basis. That's the longest in the history of Eskom that we had to do load shedding. And just to explain why in January and not why in winter, In winter, we have all our plants back on plant maintenance, and we do our plant maintenance outside winter because winter is high demand. So in January, that's where you find quite a lot of our plant on plant maintenance. And if over and above that, you have unplanned events, that's when the system becomes constrained. Now, we don't only have problems in generation, we do have outages in transmission, and the Western Cape issue was also both generation and transmission. We had a few events in December of 2006, and a major event in May 2007. In the distribution sector, we had this big event in May 2007, but also we need to make the point that in the distribution sector, you still do have interruptions, small in magnitude, say interruption, but the frequency is quite high. And it happens in municipalities. I think in the context of load shedding, those events may be insignificant, but I think we should not forget that we need to focus and make sure that infrastructure refurbishment and investment in the municipalities is important, because we can build a lot of power stations, and the next few years, you've got a problem that you cannot deliver electricity to the last mile and to the houses, and we need to make sure that we don't forget that problem. This may be very busy and you may not see the numbers, but this is just a representation of the past 21 days since the 14th of January. As I've indicated, we started 9th of January just to show the load shedding trends. The last column shows when we did load shedding and how much we did load shedding. Since the 4th of February, we have not done any load shedding. But what is important is to look at the total of unplanned outages. You could see there from 5,000 in one point, 6,000 in one point. That represents almost two power stations of unplanned events. And most of them had to do, or quite a chunk of it, had to do with coal-related issues, and which we call outage reductions. And we have seen a decline over the past few days, where we now more, in fact, in the last few days, last 3 days, the unplanned has come to about 2,000 megawatts. It is best it has been since the beginning of this year. But I think maybe just to highlight one day which was very problematic, the 24th of January, where we did the highest amount of load shedding. That also prompted us to ask the industrial customer to reduce. When you start doing 4,000 megawatts of load shedding, you begin to stress the system, you're running at the edge, and any problem that may arise, you can actually collapse the system. Now, what is collapsing the system? You know, when we talk about load shedding, people talk, it says it's blackout. Now, from a technical point of view, blackout is when the whole country is without electricity. And if you do that, the ability to come back to restore the country to power could take weeks. That is, you could have 2 weeks of no power in a country. The reason we are more vulnerable compared to New York, where they've had this and they've restored in a number of days, is that we don't have powerful neighbors from a power point of view that helps you come up. When you have a problem in Italy, which you had in 2003 and in a number of European countries, their ability to come back very quickly because their interconnections are very, very strong. You know, neighbors can help them come up. We don't have that. We have to start our process ourselves. So we watch that very, very carefully to make sure that we don't go into a total collapse of the system. And 24th of January, we were very, very worried in terms of where we are. Hence, we have to ask industrial customers to reduce load and help the system. And that's why we didn't go there. I'm not going to go. I think I've already indicated some issues there. We're running our plant harder. The reserve margins are much lower. Our generation capacity is in midlife. The requirements of refurbishment. And we've seen outages increasing. And we need to focus on the municipalities in terms of refurbishment and maintenance backlog. Talking about the build program, I think I've shared this with this committee before, and as I've indicated, When you look at 2007, we had just under 40,000, and we were on a line previously of a growth of 2.3% of electricity against a GDP of 4%. With the ASCISA aspiration of 6%, that translates to 4% growth in electricity, and it puts us to close to 80,000 megawatts by 2025. And that's, we're now building our capacity on the 6% GDP growth. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but we have a funnel of projects, and the maturity of each project is put in categories. The build is what is already approved for construction, it's 16,000. Before the build, we've got project infeasibility in business case development. Before that, pre-feasibility, and quite a lot in opportunity identification and also in research. And as we mature the project, they end up in the construction phase. So as you can see, as much as we have 16,000 approved for construction, there's lots of projects that are in the system and are in various systems to get approved up to the build program. In numbers, we have approved for construction 16,000 megawatts already. We have approved projects 2004, and this year we're going to do quite a lot of approvals. This is going to increase substantially, and it's not only in generation. We've got transmission 15.5, distribution 25, and since 2004, we've already spent 37.5 billion rand in the build program. We already also built two new gas-fired stations in the Cape, the Atlantis and Mossel Bay. They're already operating. They're part of the system. We have brought this. This is slightly outdated. We probably have now 1,500 megawatts of power coming out of the old power station that we've demothballed. We've built additional transmission lines. The big power station in Paralel is under construction. Then we're also constructing a pump storage in KZN called Ingula, and we have a number of projects which are in various stages of being approved. As I've indicated, we are also looking at transmission projects, not only this generation projects. To highlight, I think the biggest transmission strengthening that we're doing is strengthening the corridor from Mpumalanga to the Cape, because in the Cape you only have Quebec and the OCGTs, and most of our power stations are still in Mpumalanga, so we're making sure that we can strengthen that corridor, and we're strengthening the corridor into the KZN because of the growth in the Richards Bay and Durban area, and of course we're preparing for the construction of the industrial activity at Kuka, and we need to strengthen that. And on the north side, we are strengthening the connections between the new power stations and the total grid. So a number of transmissions happening to strengthen the grid and connect new power stations. Now, in terms of capacity expansion challenges, I just also need to mention some of the issues that we are dealing with. As I've indicated that we are building substantial capacity in a world where lots of people are doing it. One of the issues that we had to deal with when we opened our new tenders for the new power stations called Mirupi, the first issue that we had to deal with, we had anticipated that at least 10 companies would respond to our tender. In the end, we ended up with two. We did a lot of homework to find and actually focus how much this power station is going to cost us. But when we opened the tender, we were surprised that it was actually 30% higher than we anticipated. And when we talk to other utilities in the world, they are seeing the same pressures of prices going up from what they had forecasted. And that also, and 30% of a few billion is a lot of billions. I mean, we're talking about we will be starting at 66 billion forecasted, but at the moment we're ending up at 80 billion. And of course, there's still risks. Until we finish the project, we cannot confirm that is the final number. So those are the kind of issues that we're dealing with. So it's availability of suppliers. Skills is an issue globally. Project engineering skills to build and construct this is a global phenomenon. And the last issue In fact, the last two issues, land acquisitions, when we do our transmission lines, it requires lots of rights-of-way servitudes, and we're getting difficulties in negotiating rights-of-way servitudes, and it's one of the issues that could delay our project. And lastly, given the size of the build, clearly the issue of tariffs and the level of income for ESCOM is critical for us to be able to successfully fund this and conclude it. Financial consideration, we're currently in a five-year plan of 150 billion. When you look at the next window of 5 years, we are now at 300 billion. When you look at up to 2025, it's still an assumption, it's not confirmed yet, but the total program could be in excess of 1 trillion to 1.3 trillion. And of course, the final number will emerge. Now, 300 billion, almost twice the previous five-year plan, and we're talking to the regulator and the shareholder around how to fund this. What we also have got information about is that the rating agencies have looked at our capital plan and our tariffs. They've expressed some concerns in the public domain, and we're talking with the shareholder and the regulator on how we bridge those concerns. This is our credit rating, and for a utility which is having a huge capital expansion, your credit rating is important to be able to access funds and also access funds at competitive rates. Currently, lots of A's on our credit rating grid, but there's already some noises about our rating. The one credit rating agency have indicated that they're putting us on a credit watch with a negative outcome. What it means is that if we are not able to respond decisively on the concerns that they put on the table, they are likely to downgrade our credit rating, and we're working to deal with that. Fitch also has changed the outlook from stable to negative. The message is, even with the sizable increases in tariffs, when you look at the balance sheet, it remains under stress. So there's an anticipation that even beyond tariff increases, something must come. We're looking at shareholder support to deal with the financial sustainability of ESCOM going forward. In terms of funding options, the electricity tariff is one, external borrowing is another, shareholder support is another. The fourth is vendor financing, where large suppliers are able to borrow money to the project on a competitive basis, and we're looking at that as an option in some of the projects. The other issue, which has got a double meaning, is the price of electricity in South Africa compared to other countries. We do a benchmark every year. The last benchmark from this one, we were 30% cheaper in 2006. In the current benchmarking, we are 74% cheaper than Canada. So the gap between us and Canada is 74%, and it's good in terms of the vessel output currently, but it's bad when you look at the gap between the price of electricity and the price of new power stations. So there's a huge gap to go to where we need to go. And again, maybe this also indicates that even with substantial increases in electricity, because of the gap, it's going to take us some time we'll remain competitive in the global terms when you look at this metric. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but I think it's an important issue that needs to be reflected on, the 2010 FIFA World Cup. There are a number of challenges. The first one is host cities, infrastructure in the host cities. And then from an ESCOM point of view is the total national power system. And in ESCOM, we've responded in putting a dedicated capacity to look at this. There's an executive full-time looking at this. is working with municipalities, is working with the LOC. We're identifying all the risks and making sure that to an extent possible, we can begin to put risk mitigation strategies now. And I'm confident that most of it will be dealt with, but we need to acknowledge that the total system, the FIFA World Cup will happen in an era where the total system is under stress. And some of the things that we're doing now is to make sure that we can remove the serious threat to anything happening in 2010. Solutions being implemented, the presentation that has been received, titled the National Response Plan, I think articulate in detail some of the things that have been approved by government and have been aggressively been pursued. And I think the details in there, I'm just going to summarize what are the issues. I think the National Response Plan articulates the supply side options. The long-term adequacy plan is essentially the ESCOM build program, the additional coal generation. I've not spoken about coal generation, but coal generation is the ability by industrial customers to produce electricity derived from their waste heat, waste gases, and there's a serious option that we're looking at. And of course, there's IPPs which have been allocated 1,000 megawatts, which should come by 2009. On the demand side, power conservation program, which is articulated in the presentation, demand side, behavioral change program, and fast-tracking medium and long-term initiatives, but also around demand side. And the sectoral interventions that have been looked at, the combination of the supply side and the demand side will give us the space we need to run the system much more stable than we've seen in the past months. Within ESCOM, we have to put a recovery strategy that supports the National Response Plan, and we looked at six streams. I'm not going to go into the details, but just to give you, summarize what it is. The first one is to do with planning, resilience, and risk management. We acknowledge that there's a lot of things that we need to strengthen in the risk management and the planning part. There's a power buyback, where we're identifying industrial processes that can lend themselves to be bought back by ESCOM, and we're negotiating with some customers there. It can give us some relief. Supply side recovery is making sure that we can focus on unplanned events and reduce them, and also looking at the coal supply to our power station, which has been a factor in the current challenges. Demand reduction, I think there's a lot that we've talked about, the GSM, power conservation, energy efficiency, and so forth. Public confidence and communication, a key part of us being successful during this period, and of course, employee morale. And as much as our employees are working very, very hard, the fact that we are in the news every day, the fact that there are comments which are made that impact on them, the fact that they live in communities, they have to answer questions about ESCOM, we need to make sure that they remain focused during this period so that we can go through this with the employees that are focused and can deal with the issue. The mandate of the recovery plan, we articulated a period, a set of periods where we needed to do specific things. Clearly, up to 2012, we have a very tight system. In total, during that period, we want to take out 3,000 megawatts so that we have space. But we've broken down that period into the first 4 weeks, which should finish by the 1st of March, and is the period that we're in, starting with a lot of load shedding that happened in January to stabilize the system. And by and large, I think we've moved with that. The next one is going into a power rationing space. But the most important one is a longer-term program of power conservation, which will bring in quotas, incentives and disincentives so that people could actually respond through incentives rather than just only a stick. And that's what is articulated in the first presentation on what we're going to be doing to actually make sure that we can get the 3,000 megawatts in the next 4 years and get the system to be stable. And just to show you what has happened, by and large, the industrial customers and the mines have come to the party with a 10%. We're still seeing a limited progress with residential and commercial and agricultural customers, largely because there are many and it's difficult to measure individually. So that's where we still have to do a lot of work to get that reduction to happen. On our side as ESCOM, we've been able to relieve the coal situation. Most of our power stations now do have the coal. The situation is still very, very tight, but at least we do not have a lot of megawatts being unavailable as a result of coal. So that's where we are currently. Hence, we'll be not doing load shedding since the 4th of February, but we need to acknowledge that quite a lot of that has happened because industrial customers have come down by 10%. The other issue that I wanted to just highlight without going into the detail was the issue of the coal situation. What are the issues there? The issue in the coal is the coal quantities, what is available for the power stations, the stockpiles. They've been diminished to levels which we're uncomfortable with. We want to have stockpiles for each power station that can last 20 days. And we're currently below 10 in some of the power stations, and we're bringing that up. Coal quality is not only about, you know, the wet coal not being able to burn, but it's also that when the coal is wet, there are problems with the handling of the coal, there are problems with the transportation of the coal, and it begins to impact on the output of your station. And of course, the fact that we have to do quite a lot of transport of coal when you've got heavy rains, you also begin to impact on the logistics of delivery of coals to our power stations. We've got two stations that require a lot of deliveries of coal by road, and it is impacted by wet weather. And what we have done in terms of coal, I must say that we have had very good support from the members of the Chamber of Mines, the coal miners, and we're working with them to actually identify what needs to happen and identify what deliveries we need to make, and it's beginning to take shape. What we want to do is that by winter we should have at least stockpiles which are over 20 days so that we can go through the winter without worries about coal. And we're confident that with the plans that we're putting on the table, that should happen. Some conclusions, Mr. Chairman and members. As the minister have indicated, the power system is tight, will remain so for a number of years. But this presents an opportunity for us as South Africa to look at energy efficiency as an important aspect of our lives. I must say, at ESCOM, despite the challenges we've had, I'm overwhelmed by the support that people across society have been given to us. Businessmen that come to me phone and come and say, we've got a footprint of advertising space, we've got a footprint of people that come to our stores, how can we help? And I've not been overwhelming personally for me in this difficult time. And I'm confident that despite the challenge, we will win. I've got no doubt that as much as it remains dark, there's a light at the end of the tunnel that will make sure it's energy efficient. Thank you.
I see you've also been receiving some of those ESCOM checks. I thought that with people saying the economy was adversely affected, the one saving grace for the economy was that cell phone share prices went through the roof because so many people were SMSing ESCOM jokes. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hand over to the co-chair at this point. I don't know, do you have any questions?
Morning, members, and we thank the minister on the brief explanation on the current situation and the presentation by the CEO. I'm going to open this point, this time for questions. What I'm going to do, if we can maybe per member at this point in time, ask two questions per member, so that we can all be able to ask questions, because we're going to have this 30 minutes for questions, and then at 11 we're breaking for tea, and then we come back again. Then all of us will be able to have a second bite, if not the third one. So I'm opening this time for questions, members. I'll start with Honorable Sibiya. Honorable, next to Sibiya. Uh-huh. No, here, just next to Mr. Van Dyck, Honorable Tepland, Honorable Matua Hela, Honorable Smith, oh, and my co-chair. Okay, Honorable Sibiya.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, the Minister, the CEO, comrades, colleagues in general. I'm talking from a position of a little fear. I don't know where it comes from, but in part it comes from the fact that I don't understand matters that it do these megawatts and the megawatt bar. The question I have is on this page 5. Now, I heard the CEO indicating that the space between the red and the blue indicates the reserve margin of ESCOM, which also suggests the level at which the system is functioning. And he said the narrower the white space in between becomes, the more strain is imposed on the functioning of the system. And he said if it happens that it can be narrower than it is, we run a risk of the system collapsing. Now, that's what perhaps in part brings about the fear to me. Now, as ESCOM, can we say with certainty and more confidence than we have as a country that we have looked at all the possibilities of the problem we are faced with and we have done almost everything in your power to see to it that even by an accident or a mistake, we don't have that collapse? And if it does, can we survive economically for a day as a country? Secondly, last time we were having a workshop somewhere at Caledon Spa, and then I think it was one of the officials from the DPE who indicated, if I remember well, I might have misheard him or her, that the government intends to sell its interests in Cabora Bassa in Mozambique. I might have missed it. Now, what I want to ask is, if indeed that is true, is it not one of those factors which could be filtered into our attempts to deal with this crisis of electricity? I mean, in the event of us not selling it, that's where my question is. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. Maybe just a remark before I ask the question, a remark to the CEO on this presentation, the one that we dished out lately. It says that in the challenges for ESCOM, the CEO said that South Africa must get confidence in ESCOM again, but what I missed in the presentation is nothing has been said about ESCOM's position as a monopoly and how to attract foreign investments if they can't participate freely in the market to produce, buy and sell power in South Africa. I think this is a major thing that needs to be addressed sometime, somehow in this committee. Chairperson, my question is to the Minister. Minister, you were part of the cabinet in 1998 when the white paper on energy policy was signed. Secondly, on 19 June 2006, you replied to one of my own written questions by saying, and I quote, "We are confident of a reliable electricity supply in the future." Those were your words. Now the question is, whether you were informed by your department or ESCOM after June 2006, after you answered my question, that South Africa would run out of electricity reserves and that we would suffer blackouts and quotas in the future. If so, why did you not inform Parliament or the committee since June 2006 about the crisis that all of a sudden happened. My second question, Chairperson, I want to know whether it is true that Eskom got rid of huge coal supply companies with massive capacity and you performed well in the past, like Agri Logistics, and then instead Eskom appointed small emerging contractors who failed to supply enough quality coal stock on time to power stations. And of course, as a result, now Eskom wants to increase its coal reserves, as we just saw in the presentation, over the next few years with 45 million tons, and as a result will have to pay more for this coal, for example, almost 11 billion, as it is not part of the original purchase operation. Now, why now is Eskom engaged in a new trade contract all of a sudden? Because if Eskom was managed well in the past, we would not have been another 11 billion burden on the taxpayer. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jay. On Friday, I had the opportunity to visit Puning mine, one of the Anglo Gold Ashanti's mines near Carltonville. And this specific mine is only 22 years old, which is relatively young in mining terms. And they got the latest technology. From 2002 to 2007, they have started implementing a program to reduce their electricity usage, and they managed to reduce it by 17%. The problem that they have is that they now are required to reduce their usage by a further 10%. And what is also difficult is for them to reduce the usage at other mines, which doesn't have the same cutthroat technology as they have at Mponeng. And a further problem, you know, with regard to the impact on the economy, is that they lose 3.5 million rand a day at this specific mine alone. And the impact it has on the workers is that they work on a performance-based system. So if they don't get an opportunity to produce extra, to get some extra ore out of the mine, they don't get that extra income. Secondly, I've heard that there's some illegal mining of coal mining in this insensitive wetland areas in Mpumalanga, where people, because of the fact that they think that there's a shortage of coal, go out there on their own, go and mine some coal or track the coal out without proper EIAs being done, because they're not affiliated to any company. Is the minister aware of that problem in the sensitive wetland areas, and how will it be addressed?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I greet everyone that's here, the Honourable Ministers, and the officials, and all the Honourable Members. I also have to apologize for being late. One of my questions starts on page 21. It relates to the credit rating concerns. Bullet point 2 in relation to financing plan not yet defined. So when will this plan be defined? We have to know this. My second question is on the industrial customers that have to reduce their usage. Mr. Maroga came through very strongly on television in relation to accepting accountability for what is happening right now in the country. I commend him for that, because it's not easy to just come out like that and accept accountability. I commend you on that, Mr. Maroga. But now, also it comes out about heavy fines. We understand that this is an emerging situation, and we have to, all of us together, we have to solve this problem and work on this challenge. Now, when it comes to domestic use, how do we know that we overuse? And on the industrial customer side, is that when they pay these heavy fines, who is going to decide on how much they have to pay? Are they going to be taken to court? Is the court going to give them these fines? And is it going to be balanced on how much they lose, which connects with the question of the Honourable Tablan here in relation to job losses and in relation to production losses. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we appreciate the briefing, but unfortunately it's 5-6 weeks after the event started, so it's a bit unfortunate that Parliament as an institution has been briefed 5-6 weeks later. But in any event...
Now, let me call you to order there. In November, we had 2 briefings from ESCOM. You were not present, so you don't know about
them. Well, I'm not a member of the committee, so...
Then don't make statements you don't know about.
But since the problem started on the 9th of January, we've only been briefed formally now. That's correct statement. But can I proceed with my questions? The one is...
Chairperson, a point of order. Can I have a point of order? You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. We had a meeting in November on ESCOM. But nothing was said about this crisis. So I fully agree with my...
Take your mic off, Honourable Smith. Mr. Van Dyke, you were present at 1 of 2 meetings that took place in November. Now, I ask you, for your own sake, to please understand that if you're not present at the meeting, it is not my duty to inform you about what transpired. You are absent at your own risk. I'll pull out the records, Mr. Van Dyke.
Can I proceed with my questions?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm a bit concerned that we live in a false sense of security. We have a 10% cut, and I think the mining community is feeling it the most sincere. There's about 17,000 job losses on the Standard Media hanging in the balance. That's if I understand the media correctly. Secondly, I'm also concerned about the fact that the OCGTs, the open cycle gas turbine, from what I've been informed, is going to cost in the region of, and that's the calculation to which I've been informed, up to 400 million rand per month on the basis of if Eskom were to pay 6 rand per litre of diesel. Now, I'm not sure what the arrangements have been, but that's a rough calculation as to what it's going to cost Eskom. And if that capacity, OCGT capacity, was doubled, of course that would increase to double the amount, about 800 million by automatic standard. But in my view, it's concerning to see that Standard and Poor's have put Eskom on negative watch. And one of the issues I don't see here, and which I've also been informed, is that it's been due to management concerns. Could you confirm that? Because there's been a negative watch placed in Eskom inter alia due to the asset and liability ratio, due to should Eskom embark on the massive loan and recapitalization program. But it's an issue which needs to be confirmed or denied by Eskom, which in the markets out there has been indicated as one of the concerns why Eskom has been put on a negative watch. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Chair. No, I think just to say that my worry is very similar to Mr. Smith in the sense that we tend to be lulled very quickly into a sense of security when we install pretty much a crisis mode. And part of the concern, I guess, emanates from the fact that you've got the industrial consumers feeling the brunt at this stage, and really when it comes to residential and household management of the use of electricity, that seems to have been put on the back burner somewhat. And I'm worried that we lose the momentum, really, in terms of awareness as far as ordinary users are concerned. My questions pertain to the Chancellor House matter that was raised by the Mail and Guardian twice, if I recall, early in November and now 2 weeks ago, and I think last week again. We did have a discussion with yourself in November on this matter, where you assured us of the process and gave us certain assurances in that regard. I wonder if, for the purposes of this meeting, if you wouldn't go through the actual process. Number one, if you have any concerns about it. Number two, whether any extraordinary measures were taken to ensure the integrity of that process, because I think that becomes an issue that seems to be lingering well, certainly in the minds of the editors of the Mail and Guardian, if not the other media houses. The Business Day yesterday ran a story to the effect that with the amount of coal anticipated to be stockpiled by Eskom, that even if you were to shop globally, we would not be able to secure 45 million tons. Just your response to that, and whether any steps have been taken either in consultation with local mining houses or international mining houses to secure that kind of stockpiling. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mkhunu.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My first two questions will be in relation to the requirement of 45 million tons of coal, is perhaps the department aware that there are mines which were closed, especially in KZN, which are not open, which are not operating right now, which perhaps could be opened in order to supply more coal? And then there are also these small mines which are done by people in Nongoma, and then the Z mine in Mashabatini. The second question is about the use of Jozini Dam in the production of electricity, if it is possible to get that attended to as soon as possible, because the water is there and there is a lot of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've got two quick questions here. The first one would be on the gap of electricity prices between this country and a country like Canada, which is about 74%. It is said that the prices will remain competitive thereafter. I just want to know as to how much is Eskom going to charge the consumers the electricity? Because earlier on it was mentioned that 18% will have to be paid by the consumers for adding the capacity of the power stations. The second question would be on the power rationing. I'll be interested to know, for instance, in my constituency, they will want to know as to how are we going to ration the power, because I'm told that in countries like Brazil, they do ration power, and those who consume more, then there are penalties thereof. So I would want to know as to how are we going to do it here in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Followed by Honorable Kota.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Just one question, quite a number has been asked. It's quite a very good and impressive build program. But then the question is, how do you reconcile it with the challenge of people and skills? And what's the plan to meet this right up to 2025? Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair, somewhere along in the presentation it was mentioned that we the cheapest electricity in the world. Isn't that a hindrance in the fact that IPPs won't be able to come and produce electricity as cheap as Eskom can? So they won't be able to come on to the... Thank you.
Honourable Dutler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is just on the basis of expansion of the last 2 years. I know there's been a strain on the system because of servicing previously disadvantaged communities that are now have electricity. What I'd like to know is, will the expansion program to areas that aren't electrified right now continue, and what kind of strain will that put on the national grid? And is there a is there a rollout plan pertaining to these extensions for previously disadvantaged communities? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're not going to break for tea at 11 because I see we've got more questions. Can we break at quarter past 11? Can we get the response now from the Minister and the CEO?
As I understood, Honourable Sabir is talking about the possibility of Jacob calls a blackout, which technically is a... Now, clearly that's our biggest concern. So we're going to err on the side of caution. We will load shed more if we have to. And the crisis that emerged in mining arises from this, in that we invoked the chief executive correctly, in my view, very correctly, invoked the force majeure, which means that they could not say to the mines, we guarantee supply. And they had to do that contractually and morally. It was important to do that, because if you've got people down a mine, you must alert people. The mines responded to that correctly also by pulling people out of the mines. Since this had never happened before, there was a period where we had communication about can you continue to operate the pump systems and air conditioning and other compression systems. And we then met with the mines on the Sunday and agreed that, okay, we had to establish a new supply regime. We could not rely on the former contracts because that requires guarantees. You had to establish a new supply regime, which is based on firmed power offers, etc. So it took a lot of negotiating, and I'll cover some of Honourable Blanche's questions too. The difficulty that we had in the discussions with the mining industry is precisely what was indicated. Many mines have been saving energy. This is a request made to them last year or more. Please start becoming more efficient. So some mines have been able to. The ones with better equipment can do that. So it's not possible to expect every mine to cut by 10%. Also, some of the very deep mines require far more electricity to keep their systems moving. So the arrangement that we've been working on and have reached with the mines is that each mining group decides what it wants to do between its mines. Some would not cut by as much as 10, some can do more. It's a flexible arrangement that's done between the mines. But it illustrates the kind of complications that occur. With that, we have to negotiate with the big smelting plants. Each smelting plant is different. A relatively small plant can close down quite quickly. A massive aluminium smelter, you want to close it down very slowly or reduce it down. So what I'm saying is that in the situation that Jacob showed you there, where we had nearly more than just under 10,000 megawatts out, we had to take emergency steps that led to the specific crisis in the mine. Because other companies have similar contracts, but they didn't close down because they said we're prepared to take the risk. But obviously no sensible mining company is going to take a risk of having people down there and things go on. So we will be very cautious on trying to prevent a collapse for the same reasons that he indicated. South Africa is in a situation where to rebuild would be very difficult indeed. So inconvenient and problematic as it is, it's far better to have load shedding than to risk that. And this is where Jacob showed you our first priority is to rebuild the stability of the system, get to a position where the threat of that is less likely. On Kaburabasa, I'm not sure. South Africa's got no interest in Kaburabasa. What I think was being reported to you was that the Mozambican government was buying the Portuguese government interests in Kaburabasa. Kaburabasa does supply us 1,200 megawatts roughly on average. There's not much more we can get from it. For about to give us more, they'd have to build the North Bank. It would take quite a lot of time. So we don't really have any neighbors, as Jacob said, close to us that we can get big supplies from. Inga in the Congo is quite far away. You've got to bring it down a big supply line. The project that's most likely to take place is a project in Botswana, Mamabolo, which is close to Medupi, which is also in Limpopo and the Lephalale area. But that's a bit behind schedule compared to our project. We hope that will come on stream and be useful. I think we've debated often, Honorable Van Dyk, this question of Eskom and monopolies and your abiding belief that the private sector will solve everything. We're happy to go back and discuss that again. The model that we've adopted is a common one. I think certainly the experience since 2004 has shown it to be the most successful one, and that is to have a large utility, in this case in state hands, and then to also allow for IPPs to come in. In a situation like this, I think the merits of having Eskom are manifest, because we can now undertake as strategic investors, we can undertake programs that the private sector will never undertake. It's just not going to do it. I'll come to IPPs later. So yes, the model is one that we feel is a useful one, that we will bring in IPPs, and we'll keep Eskom as the major utility that allows us to shape the system, to take the pace of investment, and also get the benefits of bringing in some IPPs. I shudder to think what position we would have been in if Eskom had been owned now, as I'm sure you would have liked it to have been, by some consortium of banks or the EDF. I really shudder to think what would have happened. So I think the model we've got now is a very sensible one, it's a balanced one. Most countries in the world are doing something similar. You must look very closely at the 1998 white paper. It mentions almost in passing that we probably need more capacity by 2007. And that's because, as I indicated in my introductory remarks, at that period in time, supply was not the key factor. If you look at that, the main bulk of that, rightly so, was dealing with distribution and the reform and restructuring of the electricity system. The level of supply that we did bring in fact, as we indicated with the return to service and gas-fired stations, was fairly significant. What we accept, and have accepted for some time, is that really it would have been wiser to have said to Eskom, you build the big base load stations, and we should have done that, as we've said many times, probably 2 years earlier than we did. So we accept that. In my own statements, I'm happy to go back and look at those and defend them. What I've tried to outline here is that we have got a big system. It is a reliable system. What hit us is this emergency, and we can get out of it. I mean, the difference that we will never agree on between the two parties is, for you believe and hope, I think, almost, that there's a catastrophe on the doorstep, and we believe there's no catastrophe on the doorstep. We can get through this. We've got to work together in combination and solve the problem. So our priority now is not to rush around arguing who was wrong in 1998, is to get ourselves through this process. But we're quite happy to go back and debate with you the issues that I've had. And we acknowledge very clearly, and Jacob, and we acknowledge that we got these short to medium term planning things wrong. We should have probably been better prepared in the event of something like this. But those are matters that we will grapple with, and we nearly need to get ready to make sure that we don't get caught the second time, which I'm sure we won't. On coal supplies, I'm sure Jacob will deal with that. I've covered, I think, Honourable Sablanche, some aspects of the mining issue. But let me use this opportunity, which will come up later too, and Jacob could say something as well. One thing that we would really like to look at a bit more carefully, if you saw his later slides, you saw that we're saving significantly on industrial customers. But we're not making as much progress, and I think it was your question on your chairperson, with households, and really would like to get that balance right. If you recall that slide, you'll see it's 1,200 from industrial and 1,800 from the broader society. Now, if we can get the 1,800 and we're not getting there, it gives us much more space to move. Now, two things we want to say with the mining, whatever we can do for big in crucial sectors, we'd like to get back to the highest possible level of supply. But we've got to do it in a managed and phased approach. If we can get the more general savings, I think it gives us more space to go back. The mining industry have indicated, and I think they're right, that it is possible for them to save 10% anyway. Some minds argue they've done it already, others say they haven't and it has to be done. So this is a matter for ongoing engagement. But I just want to stress, as I said a moment back, exactly how each mining group decides to deal with its mines must be left to them. We do not impose a 10% target on every single mine. We say to an Anglo Gold, your target is 10%. How you want to do it, do it. And I don't want to go into all the technicalities and details, but a lot depends on the mines, the richness of the ore body, what they're going to do. But what we can say and thank them for is that I think the mining industry have been exceptionally cooperative in this matter. On illegal coal mining, I'm not sure if you're aware of it. If it happens, you must report it to DME. Frankly, it would be a very silly exercise. You know, we're not talking about little lumps of coal here. You know, if I come to the question, we're talking about significant quantities. So no one, someone who starts some small-scale mining in the wrong area, that mineral and energy will have to deal with it, but it's also a futile exercise because we're looking at significant supplies of coal, not small tranches here and there. On the credit rating and the financing plan, let me say a little bit. Look, it's our preference that we are rated as we are. It helps with the cost of capital. But we're an unusual electricity utility that has such a high rating. So one must not conceive of this as some absolute disaster that we might get downrated. We would prefer not to be. It's far better not to be. But we, one of that very few elite group in the world that has this rating, which is very, very close to the sovereign rating. Now, if we can retain it, we'll look at it. But how we deal with that is shown. There's a lot of discussion. And remember that this requirement is for the next five-year period. So on the immediate term, I'm sure when you listen carefully tomorrow, there will be something said on the short term. But on the capital structure of Eskom and the price increases, we need to do more work. And I can answer your question. You recall that NERSA said that the increase for this year is 14%. That the years after is still under discussion. And that has to be under discussion because this particular situation has really brought home that we've got to look at the use of electricity. So higher prices have got two functions, forcing people to use it more carefully and helping us to finance the build program. So the new capital plan for Eskom is not something we're going to give you tomorrow by the Minister of Finance. This is a matter that will be discussed in the context of what's our pricing trajectory over the period. We may have to consider issues like a short-term increase as well, but for the present, we're going with the 14, we'll look at that carefully, and I'm sure that the capital plan from our side would need to be done. Our target is to get this clarified by the middle of this year or so. On the rating agencies, I don't know where you've picked up in the market. I haven't picked up in the market that it's management of Eskom is the problem. I think that's just an inaccurate proposition entirely. Why should Eskom have an A rating yesterday and suddenly management problem? Not correct. You mustn't start making these alarmist statements. This is not correct. And the statement is absolutely clear. If you're going to put 300 billion of capital in, you need to know what is government's view on two matters. What is your price going to be for that same period? And currently, they only know what it is for the next year, which is 14%. So they're saying, but we don't have enough clarity. Where are you at? What's going to happen? And secondly, they need to be very clear that the shareholder, which is government, will back Eskom. And we'll deal with these step by step. But the notion that it's a management problem that's leading to this is wrong, absolutely wrong. On the issue of industrial customers, fines, etc., what I'd refer you to is if you look at the back of this other presentation, there's a bit more detail here. But let me explain to you what the power conservation program is, and it answers your question a little bit too about Brazil and to get people to use less electricity, you can ration them. Now, we can ration the mines because Eskom can switch off the switch. We can't ration households because we can't reach each household. So rationing only works where you can control the supply to the user. And this is why, unfortunately, in this emergency situation, the burden does fall on the big industrial platform, because we can control that. So we want to move, as you saw there, we want to move as quickly as we can out of the rationing phase. We want to move to the power conservation program. For those of you who want to take the time, and it's really a fascinating study, is to look at the World Bank Energy Supply Group study that deals with these crises that have happened around the world. And we opted, as I think we've shown you in previous presentations, we opted to use the what's called the quota system. Now, if you just increase prices, some people can afford to pay it, and they just pay. So in a situation where we're in, where we've got to make absolutely sure we save the electricity, that's what our target is. We can't just hope that it will happen because of higher prices. We've adopted the model that they've used elsewhere, but the most recent use of it is Brazil. So what you do is you look at each part of your economy. For example, think of hotels and hospitality and conference centers. In South Africa, lights are everywhere on those things. So we're saying, look, that sector should be able to save more than the mines, for example. And some things like hospitals and other things can save very little. You can't ration them. So what you do is you say, for example, to hospitality, we're setting you a target. You should be able to reduce consumption by 20%, say. This is the discussion taking place. Now, what will happen in the quota is that if I carry on using my full 100%, for that 20% that was the quota, you will pay a very high tariff to try and force you to go back under. It's not a fine, it's a penalty tariff. So if I come under it, I get my usual tariff. If I go into the quota zone, I pay a penalty tariff. What you may be talking about, what we're considering, what happens if people just carry on going into their penalty? Should we not punish them further? Should we switch them off? Should we name and shame them, or should we fine them? These are matters under discussion. And the reason why we cannot introduce this system immediately is for the very reasons I'm talking about. We have to do a lot more talking. So our target date for this is April the 1st, to bring in these new quota systems and use that. But that allows us to be more flexible. It allows the users themselves to decide what best they want to do. What we will then move to after the quotas, and we've said to people that, look, we may use that quota system for 2 years. But really, we would like to move more quickly to what Jacob was also talking about, move away from the quota as such, but to use tariffs, like time of use tariffs, penalty tariffs, increase the amount of tariffs for certain areas. So we use the pricing system to get people to adjust. Now, clearly, we were moving in that direction anyway. Because of energy efficiency, we had to move in that direction. So the reason why we can so quickly come up with these proposals was that they were already being discussed. There was a lot of planning and work that was being done, but we intended to introduce them more gradually over a period of the next 3 or 4 years. So because of this situation, it gives us the opportunity to move it all forward and do it quickly. And I think it's a useful way of doing it. I'm not sure whether the briefing was late or not, Chair, but I can say we were a little bit busy. So if we missed a date, I'm afraid it was dealing with a crisis. But we're here now. We must, I think Honourable Schmidt and yourself, Chairperson, we really mustn't create any sense of false security. We want to stress, and sometimes we have to overstress and it tips over into an alarmist position, but really we must be absolutely clear that it's no good saying, oh, wonderful, no load shedding for two weeks, then are we safe? We're not. We have to bring about the behavioral change in the use of electricity. The long and the short of it is this economy must be 10% more efficient in its use of electricity. So as we grow, we must grow using 10% less electricity for every unit of output. That's the challenge, that's the target, that's what we have to do. Actually, if we could be more than 10%, it'd be even better. So there's no question that we should be lulled, that things are going to be nice and easy now. We've got to use this whole emergency situation to galvanize the whole society into reducing and saving electricity. I must say I remain disappointed, and we shout and scream, but there are far too many buildings in cities, in government, and that's where the lights are. And really, we've got to name and shame, as the President said. We've got to keep pushing. We've got to push. I saw one of the buildings of a state-owned enterprise with lights on last night. There's a sharp letter gone to that executive. Why are the lights on at that time of night? So really, and this is where I think as parliamentarians, we can play a very, very important role. We mustn't do false sense of security. Jacob can comment on the refugee prices, but clearly diesel's not our best option. It's too expensive, too problematic, the shortages anyway. The difficulty we face with the OCGTs is that we're using them too heavily. They're not designed for such heavy use. We want to reduce that. In the discussions which have been mentioned in the media, we should just say that our priority for any other gas-fired station would be gas. And that's what we have to look at and negotiate. That's a relatively complex issue, but you're quite right, these are very expensive. Jacob can outline the process, but let me chairperson say something about Chancellor House. Two things I want to say, three things. We supported Eskom in taking some really extraordinary measures on this tender process. I'm confident that there has probably not been as thorough a forensic assessment of any tender in South Africa. We cannot dictate to the suppliers who it is they want to be their BEE partners. We were aware of that position. It was known by the forensic. It was known in the bidding process. But the irony of it is that if the allegation that somehow the chairperson was supporting that group, it was very unsuccessful because they lost the first bid. And they only, in fact, came into the process afterwards when the original winners said they couldn't supply that equipment at the price that they originally promised. So at that point, we had to go back to the only other bidder. And remember, Jacob said, only two bidders. We had to go back to the other bidder and say, all right, we have to come back to you. Will you supply the steam generation equipment? So I am comfortable that this thing was thoroughly dealt with. Jacob can explain in more detail how it actually works. But in practice, and in fact, on a tender this big, it's impossible for a single person to influence it. And the chairperson had no way of being involved in all those processes that make the decision. And he was bloody unsuccessful if he was trying, since they lost it in the first time. Jacob can deal with coal. On mines, I'm not sure that we all know the old coal mines in KZN. I know them very well. Whether they become profitable now or not, I'm not sure. I mean, it's possible. The price of coal is so high. But we'll have to leave that in the hands of the private sector. I have a suspicion, knowing how old those mines are, because as you know, the ones near Dundee and others, some of them nearly 100 years old. I don't know whether, in fact, they will be able to be revived. But it's something I'm quite certain that some private sector interests are looking at. But my guess is that it might be difficult. It might be difficult. For the small-scale miners, also, I'm sure, again, provided they follow the laws, the position for coal prices is high. And our prediction is that coal prices are going to remain high for a long time because of the massive demand for coal. So I think the commodity cycle in coal and others is likely to remain fairly high. On Josini, I'm not familiar with whether you could do something, but I could be very certain that whatever was done there would be very small. I don't think you have sufficient drops and size and that could do anything big, but Jacob may know more about it, but I don't think that it would be a major contributor for energy. We can do chair the skills, the build program and the skills. I mean, I think that through GIPSA, there's a massive amount of effort going into bringing the skills up. We've got to look at three levels of skill. We need relatively skilled workers. We need skilled artisans and technicians, and then you need the very high-level skills of the engineers and other issues. Our difficulty is that at that very high level of skill, there's a world shortage. It's just a massive shortage all over the world. So through GIPSA, we've got programs to try and fast-track training of engineers. As you know, I think Eskom have reported on this before, hunting for engineers, South Africans, bringing them back. It is a challenge. It is a challenge, and we're working on it. I'm not going to enter the endless debate that comes from a particular source within Eskom about the skill issue. This is a political proposition. But there is a challenge for skills, and we're all working on trying to do that. On IPPs, the argument was that electricity is too cheap in South Africa. But what you must understand is that the price that is paid by a user was not going to be the price that we would pay an IPP for electricity. An IPP price is higher than the average price. Now, whether even with that higher price, it was an attractive or unattractive proposition, I'm not sure. But we also have to think very carefully. Just to bring an IPP in and pay them a massive rate, when we could, through Eskom, build the same equipment and charge a lower rate, well, you've got to think, now, how useful is that? Yeah? So the truth of the matter is, yes, in a situation where South Africa's electricity price is relatively low and where you've got a strong utility, the IPPs, to make themselves attractive, have to come with a reasonable price. Now, in the current situation, this is beginning to change in the favor of the IPP, because one can say, we prepare to pay higher prices, and they would see this as a more attractive proposition. So we will work on that, we'll have a look at it. But the other thing that the IPPs, one of the major obstacles to these first two IPPs was a very big argument about who carries the risk. You know, and there's a big debate, who carries the risk? So if Eskom carries all the risk, and the IPP carries no risk to crudify it, well, that's not really a sensible commercial proposition. So as I've said in this very room before, in this committee, the difficulty with IPPs is that the negotiations with IPP is more complex than procurement by Eskom to build the same thing. So for the reasons I mentioned at Otto von Dijk, we do want IPPs in. They have a benefit, they've got some, that we can have competitive pressures, but we can't have them at all costs. They're not always the best solution on this. On continuing the housing, etc., we'll want to continue that program. All we must watch is some very big connections. If they're going to happen, we must talk. Yeah. But as you've seen the program, we want to continue that. It's not going to be the main pressure on our system. What has been a pressure on the system is that as more and more people have electricity, as the standard of living has risen, their consumer patterns change. So these days people use air conditioning. That's why you've got so much more pressure in summer. So,
thanks, Minister. I think you've dealt with most of the issues. Let me just fill in where the main required details. Let me start with the coal. I think the issue is whether we have had a policy to move from the large suppliers to smaller suppliers. So let's just start with how we deal with coal as a business issue. When you build a power station, you build it on the coal resource. Before you build a coal station, you'd want to confirm that the resource will last the life of the station, which is normally 40 to 50 years. So all our coal stations, in fact, let me just say the majority of our coal stations have got long-term contracts with the big suppliers, the Anglos, the BHP Billiton, the Exaros, and last the life of the station. Now, there are two stations where we don't have the supply of the mine cannot match, or in fact, in one case, there's no mine, and it's a historical issue. But the supply of the mine cannot match the requirement of the station, Tituka and Majuba. Majuba, during the construction, we found there was a problem with the coal, with the coal reserve. It was false, you can't mine it, so we had to stop the mine, but the power station was already up. So they, all the coal come by truck to the station. And in fact, sorry, by also rail and truck to the station. Tituka, the mine can only supply 50%. Again, there was a problem with the mining process, mining, you know, can't keep up with it. So they also augment with transport. So all the others have got long-term contracts for the life of the station. What we talked about here is that there is, in some of the, even the stations where we've got dedicated mines, we are running the power station much harder, which is beyond the contractual limit of the mine. Because we're running the station as hard as we, so this is to augment. Now, the issue is not necessarily supply, the issue is the logistics to bring the coal where it is, where you find it, to the station. That's where the issue is, and it's the logistical issue. So, the issue is not about small, in fact, you know, majority of our coal supplies are with big companies, so they've got the muscle to do. And in fact, in some cases where a big company says, I want to sell this mine to a smaller company, we have said, look, we want to look at the risk associated with that. Because unless we can confirm ourselves that the risk is such that we can take it, we said, no, we want you as a big company to continue to supply, because you've got the muscle, you've got the balance sheet, if there are any issues, you can deal with it. So we won't risk ourselves, risk our supply, very important supply. You know, coal supply is the biggest cost we have in making electricity. We will be spending this year about $19 billion on fuel supply, the biggest. So we actually focus on that very, very, very clearly. So that's the issue we can deal with. Then the OCGTs, you're correct. If we're going to use the OCGTs like we use a base load station, we're going to pay a lot of money. When we bring in OCGTs, they bring as peaking plants. Now, peaking plant, you anticipate it at best to use it for 5% of the time. But when you're tight and you start using it much more, you pay the price in terms of diesel. So we don't want to use it as base load stations. We want to continue to use them as peaking. But when you're tight for short periods, you know, to avoid load shedding, you pay the price. But long term, we want to reduce the use of OCGTs. And as the minister says, it's the cost and also the availability. And one of the issues that the DME has indicated to us that we must be very careful how we use the diesel, because we don't want to now take an electricity problem and make it an energy, especially liquid fuel. You know, so that's something that also we need to watch. Let me deal with the issue of the procurement of Medupi. And I think the minister have indicated. Our procurement is such that, and I'll just tell you, take you through Medupi process. There is a technical team which looks both at the commercial and the technical aspects of a tender. They are the ones that open the tender. They are the ones that will sit and evaluate the tender. No manager will influence that process. Once they are finished, they will bring in a recommendation, firstly to a committee of EXCO. That committee will look at process, not whether who is the company, they look at process. If was the process found, are there any governance issues? And in any case, if there's any issue, they will get somebody to audit the process. That's the first committee. Then it goes to EXCO. Similarly, before, by the time it goes to board, it will probably pass about five committees, which look at process. So the ability of one individual, even myself, to say, look, go to this company, don't go to this company, will cost such a ration that it's just unimaginable. So that, I think, and what we took to the board as an EXCO is what was recommended by the technical committee. And no board member said, you know, what about, you know, there was never that discussion. The discussion is the process robust? Are there weaknesses that can be challenged? If there are any, let's go and audit. In fact, the board said,
Let's get, because it's big, and it's one of the biggest tenders that we're doing, let's go and get a Deloitte to go and audit the process. They audited the process. They did background check on everybody who associated with the tender, including Exco members and board members. They came back and said, they also did with DP staff to say, anybody who was affected by this process, we've done a background check. There isn't any conflict of interest. And indeed, we believe this is one of the best run tender processes. The outcome of the first review was that it was not Hitachi, it was Alstom. Okay? Now the Chancellor House is Hitachi. They raised the issue even with Alstom. And they say, look, in our review, we've identified Chancellor House who's associated with the ruling party. But we didn't see any political influence. In any case, the technical team is suggesting Alstom. When we're supposed to sign with Alstom, Alstom said, came back with additional costs. And when we looked at that, then we actually have to go and look and see whether if Hitachi can offer us the same with the price, you know, keep the other side. That's when we went to Hitachi. Even after that, the board said, go and audit the process. Deloitte went again, checked the same way. So I can confirm here that, you know, whatever, you know, may be reported, it is the influence by one individual or groups of people, it's not possible. The problem, the issue was thoroughly audited. There was an issue about, are we able to secure the 40 million tons of coal over the next 2 years? Is coal available? I mean, clearly we're still going to talk to miners and they will give us the indication of what they are able to do. But let me say this, that the coal reserves are there, we know that. The issue is whether we'll be able to mine them quick enough to supply our station, and I think probably that will solve. The biggest thing that worries me is the transport logistics, being able to take the coal from where it is through our roads to where we need it. That's an area that worries me, because, you know, it blocks the roads, it damages the road, and in fact, the Majuba and Tutuka problem that I've talked about is a big problem, road problem for the Mpumalanga government in which we're dealing with. We have not really fully solved it, because in terms of just the pressure they put on the roads. Hence, we want to start looking at rail so that can relieve the roads. But over the next few months, we'll be able to know what is possible, because we're still early days in the procurement of the 45 million tons. I cannot confirm about the KZN mines. I don't know about the details, so I don't know whether they'll be part of the mix. They may be, I don't have the detail. And I don't know the detail about the Jozini Dam. Rather than to say, hydro potential for South Africa is very, very limited. And hydro potential, where countries have hydro potential, they use rivers, big rivers, to dam them and get electricity. Not, you know, Jozini Dam may be big in our context, but it's not in the context of making electricity. In Southern Africa is the Zambezi River and the Congo River that have got huge potential that can still be tapped. So other than that, we don't have much in terms of size of rivers. The skills, correct. I think you're correct, as the Minister has indicated. But I think also let me give you some information that, let me just give an example on a coal station. Coal station, the biggest element of construction is the turbines and the boilers. About 70% of the coal station is those. Now, once you've contracted to other people to construct, there's still problems there. For instance, now that we've contracted to Hitachi and Alstom, delivering the turbines and boilers is their issue. And they'll source the skills wherever, and they'll deliver the turbine. The skills for us is the integration, the other things that we need to do ourselves. That we need to deal with, but yes, it is a challenge. Electrification, as you indicated, we go full steam ahead. Electrification, as much as the numbers in terms of the people to connect is high, in terms of its impact of the load, it's not that big. So we will continue with that, and our intention is that by 2012 we'll have electrified everybody, and I don't think it's going to be a big strain to the system in relation to its socio-economic impact, and we'll continue with that.
Sorry, just if I may, thanks. One issue. We mustn't throw around these issues that there'll be 17,000 jobs lost and that. It's just wild stuff. The situation is very, very clear. We discussed it with the mines. We had the union movements there. There are actually, in the mining industry, some very interesting and detailed protocols that deal with this matter. And all parties agreed that should anything like this emerge, there will be a discussion first and a protocol followed. So I'm not aware, and I'm in pretty constant contact with both the chamber and with the unions, I'm not aware of any proposal to retrench 17,000 workers. So we mustn't make that kind of assertion. Let the processes work. They work very well in the mines. And we're all working to avoid any possible retrenchment at this point. Because it would be really a pity to do that. The mining industry is buoyant. The resources, the commodity boom is there. So obviously our objective is not to retrench, but to continue employment.
Members, can we now break for tea and we will have another round when we come back? Can we break until...